Hello, this is Mark Steiner. Welcome once again. We are about to have another conversation that has been born of the book Hands on the Freedom Plow, personal accounts of women in SNCC. There's so much in this book. There's so much going on in this book, so many stories to be told. If we can, we'll tell every story in here. We are lucky that this Friday at 7 o'clock at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland's African-American History and Culture, we'll be having an event where Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, who wrote two very important passages in this book, will be there. She's a singer, song leader, civil rights activist, scholar. She was the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's SNCC Freedom Singers and the group Sweet Honey in the Rock. She's curator emeritus at the Smithsonian Institution National Museum of American History. She joins us along with Reverend Cecil Gray, who lives right here in Baltimore. He's pastor of the Northwood Appold United Methodist Church and co-founded the Freedom and Democracy Schools Foundation. And he's the son of the great civil rights activist Victoria Gray Adams, who is the first woman to run for the Senate in the state of Mississippi. She was also one of the founders and leaders with Fannie Lou Hamer of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and wrote that story in this anthology. That story was called They Didn't Know the Power of Women, which could be the subtext also of Bernice Johnson Reagan's pieces in this wonderful book, Hands on the Freedom Plow. You can meet them both this Friday night at 7 p.m. at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. And Reverend Cecil Gray and Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to just clarify. Mm-hmm. I was a founding member of the SNCC Freedom Singers. It was organized by Cordell Hull Regan, who was a sit-in leader out of Nashville, Tennessee, who came to Southwest Georgia.
Good. And so that's an important thing to say. And it was also, as much as you say a lot of this, things may have erupted through one person, but then they became collective efforts of all.
And sometimes through history, there is slippage. <You know? laughs> And so I always try to, if I know something that came from a group or that was initiated by someone, especially if that person is dead, and then it starts to slide over to my authorship, I actually don't need to say I started that.
But you did start Sweet Honey in the Rock.
I am the founder of Sweet Honey in the Rock, and I led the group for 30 years, retiring in 2004. A wonderful, wonderful communal experience for me where I learned a lot about singing and organizing and moving through issues of justice.
And moving people along with it at the same time.
Inviting them to come, being sure the door was open.
Can you talk for a minute, if we'll start with you, Bernice Johnson Reagan, and also Reverend Gray, then reflecting on what your mother wrote and other people wrote in this book, about why this book, Hands on the Freedom Plow, The Stories of Women in SNCC, Personal Accounts, is so important, not just as a historical document, but as a living will and power of what this generation can do today, Dr. Reagan.
Well, frankly, in terms of the anthology itself, it takes my breath away. I am in awe of the editors. There were six. And the effort took 15 years. And when I held the book in my hand, I tried to think if there was any corollary that I've ever run into about a major effort of organizing by women who got to a point in their lives that they wanted to themselves share something of what they were trying to do. I think it is an extraordinary effort. So I'm just humbled that my editor was Martha Prescott, Norman Noonan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was blessed that she was my editor because she wouldn't let me leave two or three times. I would have died if the book had come out and I wasn't in it. It's just an extraordinary. And it's been extraordinary to watch the way it's moving in this 21st century time. So, and your work, Mark, and supporting it is a part of what we are meeting. Wherever people go, and they want somebody else to know about the book. It's quite amazing to me.
Well, I think it's important, as some of the editors said to me before, that this book is about 20-year-old women, women in their teens and 20s. And it does speak to young women in their teens and 20s today that they have a power that they don't even know they have.
Well, I think also, for me, I'm not sure we were as conscious of being women the way we are today. We were so inside of the Black community. We would run into some stuff that we had to deal with. But it's an amazing thing to begin to move, and you find yourself next to people who are there because they're ready to move too, and it doesn't matter a lot who they are or where they come from. What matters is that they, at that point, are on the same line you're on. And you begin to move forward. There's just nothing like that. And you have to come to it yourself. It's mm-hmm. not like you pass from the first to the second grade and the teacher says you did well enough to go to this next line. It's like you have to come to it yourself. And to find yourself with company. To find yourself with company is just an extraordinary experience.
And I wonder for you, Reverend Gray, what it was like. I mean, this is a book, your mother's in it, she wrote in it. It's about the period of the generation of committed, powerful women changing America that came before you. What happened to you when you read this book?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show with you, Mr. Steiner, and you, Dr. Regan, in the name of and in place of my mother. Most of what's written in that essay, her last essay, which was also edited by Ms. Noonan, I know it. I lived some of it and have the memory of some of it. And then all that I didn't live and have the memory of, it was recounted and retold so frequently that I feel like I was there for the parts that I wasn't. You know, I hadn't come on the planet yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I'd really like to try to do is, try to share things that Mom shared with me and we talked, my mother and I were very close, so we just talked all the time. But similar to what Dr. Regan was saying, Mom said that she said she knew very early in her life that even as a little girl, she knew that she was different. Not better than, but different from most of the people in the family, in our family, as well as in the community there in Mississippi. And she went to Detroit when she was 9 years old, lived there for a year, came back to Mississippi, and that 1 year in Detroit, that kind of confirmed some things about what was possible as far as how the society could open up. But again, still different. And then when she comes into the movement kind of in full, Curtis Muhammad and Hollis Watkins, Curtis Hayes back at that time, they came to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and said, "Does anyone want to join the freedom movement?" And they came to her church. The other churches in the town wouldn't allow them to speak, but the pastor at the church where my mother attended did. And she said that night when they met and after they'd given their spiel and invited people to join the movement, the pastor said, for anyone who wants to stand. And she said that only a few people stood, but she knew, she said she didn't know what it meant, but she said she knew as she was standing, she said my life was going to change now in some kind of major way. And she didn't know what that meant, but she knew that it was coming. And then, but to link with Dr. Regan, and then I'll kind of pause. Mm-hmm. Once she moves out, you know, move into this journey, she says it was like, you know, with the SNCC people, the SCLC people, you know, the people from all the different branches of the freedom movement. She says it was like all of a sudden, what she'd been looking for all her life, there were all these people who she would, they were like her, and she was like them, and so she wasn't, you know, different anymore. Still different in general, but I guess all these different folk had found each other as they did the work of freedom.
And they did. I never met your mother, but I knew after I read her piece that I must have stood next to her in Atlantic City when we were there in 1964. And it made me kind of. This chill came over my body when I realized that was your mom. That was just.
Oh, you were on the boardwalk, Mark?
I was on the boardwalk.
That's amazing.
And
I was there, it was the first time I heard "Go Tell It on the Mountain" as a freedom song. Fannie Lou Hamer led it.
Right.
And I was right behind her. And so if you see the clip, she leads it, mm-hmm. and I am hearing it for the first time. And I'm laying an alto line next to her. And I said, oh, Lord, we got a Christmas carol doing duty at the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City. Yeah.
That's right.
They'll tell it on the mountain, let my people go.
Yes.
That was a moment.
I think when you experience moments like that, you really get a direct infusion of what your purpose can be in your life.
Yeah.
That history isn't just for you to learn it.
That's right.
And some of the things you've been given from the other generations are not just for you to put into a case. You mm-hmm. let them fly free if you position yourself so you are at risk to take a new step.
That's right.
And that is something I did not learn until I stepped across the line.
And that the pieces you wrote about were about your stepping across the line, but it was part of what you were writing about in those two essays. I mean, those two pieces were the moments that pushed you across the line and you almost didn't know it was happening. When you were a student at Albany State, is that right? Was it Albany State?
That's right, Albany State College. Yes.
When you just described Fannie Lou Hamer singing, and it made me think of something I didn't really ever think deeply about until I read what you wrote, Bernice Johnson Reagan, in this book, which was the way that you and others transformed the songs to become. Not all the songs, but some of the songs, become freedom songs. When you have that passage in there about I'll overcome, you know, instead of mm-hmm. we shall overcome, it was I'll overcome. And when you did that, I had no idea that that's how that song was transformed or that how you worked to transform these songs into songs for the freedom struggle that came out of gospel music but used different words. Talk a bit about that, because that's a really inspirational kind of thought that I never really wrestled with before I read your piece.
Well, if you take the theme song, We Shall Overcome, it has quite a journey, because it was a church song, and it was Charles Tenley, who was a Methodist minister in Philadelphia, who had come from Eastern Shore, Maryland, structured it as a hymn. And then it had been in the repertoire in South Carolina. And when they started to have their union movement, one of the songs, including sort of I Shall Not Be Moved, they would sing I'll Overcome. And so this song moved into action first on a picket line to form a union in Charleston, South Carolina. And that's during the 30s and 40s struggle. And it moved to the civil rights movement because of a place in Tennessee called Highlander, which was one of the places in the South where black and white people could meet together who were trying to change racism in the South.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And so the song actually goes to Nashville, Tennessee, and the Nashville sit-in. When SNCC is formed in 1960, the one song that was sung that night that had been done, and there were quite a few songs that they started to sing, but when they started to sing this song, they said everybody stood, and they reached across, and these are all the sit-in leaders. This is a meeting Ella Baker called, Raleigh, North Carolina.
That's right, at Shaw.
All of these sit-in leaders from all of these campuses, they were in that room, and they reached across to each other, and they sang that song. And they say that's when it became the theme song. I'm in Southwest Georgia, and I'm looking at something going on in Nashville. I hear the song. Well, I knew the song. I didn't know the song they were singing. I knew the church song.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the NAACP youth meeting, and I taught people the church song. So SNCC comes to Albany, and they come to the NAACP youth chapter meeting, and they said, are y'all singing in your meetings? I said, yeah, well, we just did a new one. And so I start, I'll overcome, I'll overcome. And Cordell Reed stopped me. He said, this is the theme song of the movement. Now, I'm sitting. I'm the secretary. I'm sitting down. I'm not getting up. He said, this is the theme song of the movement. When we sing this song, we stand. And when we sing his song, we join hands right over left.
That's correct.
Right
that's
over
correct.
Left. And we do not say, I'll overcome. We say, we shall overcome.
That's right. That's right.
So he got us together, and then he led the song. And, you know, like, when he led the song, it was sort of stayed. Some of the movement was out of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I just went, okay, this is the way we can get into the movement. I'll sing it your way. But at the first mass meeting in Albany, he started the song, but he could not finish it. The Albany surge moved into the song and spread it. So the way we sing it now, it took has to do with a congregational shift that mm-hmm. the singing of the song got in Southwest Georgia. And from that point, everybody sang it that way. So when we sing it now, it's, we shall overcome, my Lord, we shall. And, you know, you go, oh, so the songs really are free.
That's right.
They are waiting. And it's like if you know a song, and all it is a song, you don't, either your life hasn't caught up with it, but there's something that has not happened between the song you know and what you're doing in your life. Because the songs will move if you in your life step on ground that's addressed in the song, and then you'll know what it is you're doing.
It's it I mean, when you wrote the lines in the book, you wrote that the singing was powerful because we did it in the mass meetings, and the movement extended our physical space beyond the territories our body occupied. And that the singing was not just singing, how it was part and parcel of everything. It was transformative. It was part of the. It spoke to the air.
That part is not new. If you can just think about growing up in a black community, my mother would talk about a certain group. Maybe they were Pentecostal. She would say, "You can hear them half a mile away with all the doors shut." So as you move toward the church, you are walking inside of sonic energy.
That's right.
That's why we sang. Because if you produce sound, it extends the territory you occupy. Anybody coming to your body has to walk through your sound.
That's right.
And that's why they wanted us to shut up when they locked us up in jail.
Right. Right.
Can I share a quick story?
Oh, please. That's why you're here.
Okay. It's just another another illustration as far as what Dr. Regan is saying. Mom would tell the story sometimes of the pattern in the movement was whenever you're moving from one point to another, you're going from Mississippi to Alabama to Georgia, North Carolina, D.C., wherever you're moving, and particularly deep in the South, every 30 minutes you have to check in, and that's the pattern, and that's how they would track each other. No cell phones and all of that back then. But anyway, so Cheney, Schroeder, and Goodman had left from one point, and they were on their way in. And but more than 30 minutes had passed, and there was no check-in. And, but everybody, they continued to do what they were doing, concerned, but, maybe not the 30-minute mark. And then it's like an hour, it's an hour and a half, it's 2 hours, and then Mom said, she said something's wrong. And so she got with Bob Moses and said, something's wrong here. They're not checking in, and we're way past 30 minutes. And he said, what do you think? She says, it's really not what I think, it's what I know. Mm-hmm. And it's like something really bad has happened. And so then soon, maybe, I don't know if it was 3 hours, but finally another kind of communication comes, and in fact, they had been missing, they'd been hurt, killed. But anyway... So the whole group and what they were doing, they were training young people to prep. They were prepping more young people to enter into the movement. And so here this news is for these young people. This room full of auditorium full of young people who are getting ready to continue with their prep, their training, and three other young people are now have disappeared. And so they went and told the young people what had happened. And it's like, if you want to get out now, we understand, because it's this is what it is, and everyone was solemn, downcast, silent, really put down, depressed, knocked out, and somebody, I don't remember if Mom said who, but someone began to sing, and as that one voice rises, the other voices join, and then it loops and it spirals and it spirals upward and as Dr. Regan was saying, the space expands and the energy shifts, and soon everybody is singing, and the whole this defeat, this hurt, this immeasurable pain is transformed into, we're not backing up, we're going forward. And we're going to continue forward. But song and music, and again, as Dr. Regan said, sonic energy from the collective. And as you said, Mr. Shaw, it's transformative. It changes. There's literally a change in the energy. If we could see it, it would be very interesting if we could see it. But absolutely, we can feel it. Mm-hmm.
That was they were in Ohio. Being trained for Mississippi Summer.
Yes,
and,
ma'am.
That that story is told a lot by people who shared that waiting period.
Mm-hmm.
And the extension of the story is that nobody went home from
That's
those
right.
young people. Nobody went home. Everybody went to
Mississippi. They stayed.
Everybody went to Mississippi.
We're talking at the moment with Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, of course, who founded Sweet Honey in the Rock. She was one of the founders and the leaders of the SNCC Freedom Singers, noted civil rights activist, scholar, curator emeritus, Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of American History, and the Reverend Cecil Gray, is pastor right here in Baltimore of the Northwood Appold United Methodist Church and co-founder of the Freedom and Democracy Schools Foundation, and the son of Victoria Gray Adams, who helped found and lead the Mississippi Freedom Party. She and Dr. Reagan both are in this book. This is our fourth show on this book, fourth of several to come, Hands in the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC, edited by Faith Holosert, Martha Prescott, Norman Noonan, Judy Richardson, Betty Garman Robinson, Jean Smith Young, and Dorothy Zellner, some of whom have been on this show before. This Friday night at 7 o'clock, we can all meet Dr. Reagan and Reverend Gray at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture at 7 p.m., where there'll be a panel discussion on this book with them on the panel. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're talking at the moment with Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, of course, who founded Sweet Honey in the Rock. She was one of the founders and the leaders of the SNCC Freedom Singers, noted civil rights activist, scholar, curator emeritus, Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of American History, and the Reverend Cecil Gray, is pastor right here in Baltimore of the Northwood Appold United Methodist Church and co-founder of the Freedom and Democracy Schools Foundation and the son of Victoria Gray Adams, who helped found and lead the Mississippi Freedom Party. She and Dr. Reagan both are in this book. This is our fourth show on this book, fourth of several to come, Hands in the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC, edited by Faith Holosert, Martha Prescott, Norman Noonan, Judy Richardson, Betty Garman Robinson, Jean Smith Young, and Dorothy Zellner, some of whom have been on this show before. This Friday night at 7 o'clock, we can all meet Dr. Reagan and Reverend Gray at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture at 7 p.m., where there'll be a panel discussion on this book with them on the panel. As we move through some of this that we've been talking about, let me come back to the pieces that you wrote in the first essay that you wrote, Bernice Johnson Reagan, because you know everybody has these coming of age stories that people write, but yours in terms of being struck by what it meant to be young and black and in the South, and what the racism oppression was coming to you in a certain way, and the sexual oppression of black women in a way that other people have not seen write about it, at least from the civil rights movement, because as you wrote about, they always wrote about, when they talk about sex in the civil rights movement, was always about, did white women go to bed with black men? Did SNCC workers have lots of sex? That's what people talked about. But you're talking about something much more fundamental, different, and powerful in the discussion about what happened to you at the moment when you joined that movement.
Well, I think that when I heard about the anthology, I immediately knew that I wanted to write this story. Because people who have not experienced the South don't understand how interwoven and interdependent black and white lives were, and how unsheltered black people were from whatever white people thought they needed black people to do. And for me, I answered the phone. I was the counselor in the freshman dorm, and the dorm counselor was out. I answered the phone, and I very quickly realized the man on the phone was offering me $20 if I would come and meet him. And I set up a sting, and I put it off campus so they wouldn't call it a campus event. I actually thought it was against the law. And so the article talks about a very, that day, because I went to my advisor. My advisor was a black man on the faculty. And I don't know what they thought after they sent me to my class, because they said, we'll take care of it. And then they told me later, we everything's set up. And so I went to my station. I had a boyfriend. I told my boyfriend. He looked at me like I was out of my mind. And when I got to the corner, he walked past the corner. He didn't stop. But I'm sure that was the end of our relationship. It's almost like, do I want to be with somebody who would do what this woman is doing? And in a short minute of time, I found out that the police would say they were coming, but they did not come. That I went to the station with the dean of students the next morning, and the man said we went to his house, and his wife said he was out of town. And I go, he has a wife. You know, there was this crashing. There was nothing that you see on the TV or in the books that you read about the structure of society. It just collapsed in an amazing way. And I knew that somehow this was a very simple story, but I really had to write about this, because it wasn't just that it was that, but it was how many times we had to try to figure out how to get around being the object of somebody's use.
Yeah.
And powerless, and for some reason I thought, you know, it needs to be stopped. But that day I really experienced that all of the structures that were in society to protect and take care of, they were not there for us. And I realized I really had exposed the black men who went to the police to try to get them to catch this man, because they had to really barrel past the administration who did want them to go. I never knew that. So it just collapsed so much for me, and I knew that I wanted to just, it's a short story, but it is so resonant, and people see racism almost as if it's like in blocks, you know. No, you are nursing the babies, you're cleaning the house, you're ironing, you're cooking, and you're not just, and then you have to get from your house to their house, and sometimes you're riding with them. It is an amazing thing we took on to try to destroy that system.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very necessary. And I just needed to do that small story, because once I got that story out, people come and they tell me all of their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And when nobody, there was nothing to say that anybody would get anything done to them for what I thought, there must have been a law someplace. There wasn't a law anyplace.
You know, when you read the way you describe it in the book, Bernice Johnson Reagan, when you read how you describe it in the book, it's, and you have this line in here towards the end where you said it's been more than 40 years since this event happened. I still feel the loss of innocence that made me know that as a black female sexual life, I was in trouble everywhere in the society with nowhere to hide, nowhere to run, so uncovered, without shelter. With every ounce of strength I had and all my heart and soul, I joined this movement for freedom, with freedom in capital letters and an exclamation point.
Right.
That's how the people who went through that movement, people who did what you did, were as profoundly affected by that time and experience in terms of what it made them as human beings as any soldier who walked through a battlefield.
And it's the same thing as Reverend Gray standing in her church saying she wanted to join. You know, not quite sure yet what it was, but she wanted to. She could see she wanted to join. I do think you get opportunities in your life to risk your life.
Mm-hmm.
There's something in your culture that tells you, since it's very dangerous, don't be no fool.
That's right.
But I really, and I think these stories say, if you never step across that line, you'll never meet yourself.
That's real.
That is
because
true.
If you step across your line, across that line, and you're not dead on the other side.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
You used to like, okay. They didn't kill me. What can I do next? You know, you actually have a platform to strike out on to make an offering to the world you live in.
That's right.
So one of the things I think this book offers is all of these short stories about ways in which different people found that way of going through fear and going through danger to actually meet the rest of themselves.
Right.
And it was in the struggle for freedom.
And I have another question about that, but I want to turn to Reverend Gray for a minute. And Cecil Gray, if you could let's talk a bit about your mother, Victoria Gray Adams, what she wrote in this book. What the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was, and also how she, what she had to face. I mean, that people still have no idea about what it was really like, what women like your mother had to stand up to as, not as students, but as adult women taking on the role of the battle because men were being killed, men were being threatened, and women had to step to the fore as she did. I mean, your mother's story is a very important piece of the struggle, along with Fannie Lou Hamer.
No, I think to try and put it together, you know, once the work started, and you know, she was kind of on the track to some degree. She when all of this unfolded for her, she actually was an independent businesswoman, as our mom described herself. She was selling cosmetics the company was called Beauty Queen. It was one of, if not the only, and the largest black-owned cosmetics company in the U.S. at that time. And so that's what she was doing. And but the way she was approaching it was not just to make money; it was to help women have autonomy. You know, it's like, okay, so your husband's doing this and that, or your boyfriend, or your parents, or whoever. But you need to have some, you know, you need to be able to move. And so this is a way that you can do that and not be limited. And so, you know, when this so already there's this thing happening of independence, autonomy, a kind of freedom. And so when the movement happens, you know, that's a continuation at a much more profound level. I guess as everything continued to move, she would say, as far as the danger of it all, and my father was also a part of everything. Once everything, you know, started moving, my pop was also with that. And as it continued to build there in Hattiesburg and across the state and beyond, my pop lost his job, and it became very difficult for him. Finally, he could not get any work at all. There in Hattiesburg, he had to work down on the coast, down in what, you know, today it's Gulfport, Biloxi, all of that, Gulf of Mexico. And then, you know, and so he'd be gone for however many days, and then, you know, we'd pick him up and places in between Hattiesburg and down on the coast. Because it was known that, you know, that my family was about, you know, working for freedom, and that was not appreciated nor approved of by, you know, the white folk who were, you know, running the city. My mother and others, as you, you know, where you were, what you were alluding to, Mr. Steiner, it's kind of like, and I'm going to, you know, I'll just be kind of blunt. It's kind of like the white community might and did to some degree tolerate black women, you know, daring to think about, talk about, organize for freedom, but black men would simply be killed very quickly. And you know, shut out financially, and then if they continued, then killed. Like Mr. Damer, of course, was ultimately, his house was bombed. But anyway, but Mom, you know, kept going, and so just to accelerate, it got to the place where death threats would call the house and say, you know, you're going to float down the river, like Matt Charles Parker, who was a man who'd been killed and thrown into the river. We had fire drills in our house, myself, my older brother, my older sister. Mom would put us through fire drills because she's like, okay, if you wake up and the house is on fire, what do? Do you get your teddy bear? No. Do you get your books? No. What do? You get out. And, you know, so that was just a part of how we grew up. But I guess to fast forward, and my mother, ultimately, she was back and forth a lot. Well, she was really all over the country, but in great part back and forth between Mississippi and D.C., but just to link in, I want to kind of like what Dr. Regan was doing. I want to make sure the record is straight. Mom, Miss Hamer, Miss Annie Devine, Lawrence Giot, Ed King, Aaron Henry, a lot of folks were a part of, you know, building MFDP. So we don't want to just, you know, have it out there. Mom and Miss Hamer did this. And anytime you talk about Mom, you know, certainly she, you know, she stands on her own, but you also have to talk about what I call the human trinity of Victoria Gray, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Annie Devine.
Yes.
Those three women who kind of were the leadership out of Mississippi, you know, certainly for 64 in Atlantic City, and then the congressional challenge in 1965. And I guess I'll say this and maybe stop, that the connection between those three in particular, I asked Mom, so when did you all get together, you know, because they did a lot together. And she said, and also I asked Ms. Devine about this before she passed, but none of them, the three of them, they don't have, she, Ms. Hamer, and Ms. Devine, none of those three, they don't remember when they came together. They're just somewhere on the journey. There they were. Mom was kind of, you know, in the southern part of the state, Hattiesburg, Ms. Devine there, right, you know, around Jackson there. And then, of course, Ms. Hamer up in the Delta. But somewhere along the way, there they were. And then they had an apartment in D.C. because they were all in and out of there all the time. And Mom was the, you know, national director for MFDP there in D.C. and so forth. But just, you know, dangerous. But you know, you have to keep going forward. And I guess Dr. Regan said it, but, you know, people sometimes, Mom said, people say, you know, you were so brave, you know, you just weren't scared of anything. And Mom said, no, that's not true. She said, if I tell you or we tell you that we're not afraid, that's a tale. That's not true. Absolutely, it's frightening. You know, your life is on the line. But you make a decision that you have to keep going. You have to move through the fear because my mother said this once to my brother, who was about nine. He was looking up at her really sad because she was getting ready to head out again because she was gone so much. He said, Mommy, you know, we need you here. We need you at home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we need you. And my mother says, and she, this was in an interview with, I think, the Century of Women, TNT, Jane Fonda did that one back there, part three, maybe, of three parts. But anyway, Mom said she looked at my brother Tony and said, you know, I want to be here, baby. I want to be here. But if I don't go and do this work, your life and other lives will never get better. And then she headed out again.
That's right. It's
a
very powerful story. Her story is, and I'm so glad you're going to be here Friday night to represent your mom and that and what she did and clearly being a child of the movement. See, so great that is.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
I mean, that's all.
They call me a movement baby.
You're a movement baby.
Baby,
It's exactly what you are.
Well, I went to Reverend Gray's church for the service for his mother. And he did, it's a Methodist church, right, Reverend Gray?
Yes, ma'am.
And he did this prayer. And he did this prayer that cut across centuries of people reaching for a higher power. And he was talking about God, but he used all of these names, inviting the power in the universe under any of the names any of us sitting there might actually know to be with us. And I said, that's Reverend Gray's sign. And it was new ground for a Methodist memorial funeral. And the next thing that came in, there was this tree. They were going to pour libation. And you don't pour libation in Methodist churches. And the deacon had gone and got a tree. And you know that when you go to get a tree, because you pour the libation in the earth, so you need a tree with a little dirt.
Mm-hmm.
But the deacons went and got a tree that was appropriate for the mother of their pastor. It was a big tree, and two of them had to carry it in. The Reverend Gray, and he looked at how the deacons had understood this new thing they were going to do, and they really wanted to get something that was worthy of the moment. And I sat there. It was the first time I've been in the church. I said, this is different. And I said, well, you know, what else would you get from the son of a soldier like Victoria Gray, who was Reverend Victoria Gray? But, in fact, stretching us into new ways of understanding what we are doing when we try to erase the line between the we think we are, and join a certain energy in the universe and ask that energy to be with us and to hold us. So That's Victoria Gray's baby.
What you got? Thank you. I'm glad you added that. You wrote also in this book a passage. It's just a sentence, but I think there's so many. I could pull out sentences from all through both these pieces you wrote and spend a long time on each one, but let me just throw this one out. You wrote, the idea that I would be locked up, but not really locked up, had never occurred to me before participating in demonstrations against segregation policies throughout the city and county. The idea of being in jail and that being exactly where I needed to be was an antithesis of what had been taught to us by our parents and teachers. And the idea that, I mean, that is an amazing concept for people to think about. Being locked up, being in jail, but not being in jail. Who you are is not in jail. Your soul is not in jail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to understand with the pervasive way that prison is having in our community in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
This way of being someplace and people thinking they can lock you up, but they can't lock you up. But I think it's important to share it because you do need to sometimes seize the opportunity to say, this is where I stand, and you can tell me what the law is or what the law is not. I know, you know, if I go into this much county, I'm violating the segregation law. You do your job, I'm doing mine.
That's right.
And that's so much is the energy that was present for so many of us who became active during that period, and it really was a life-changing experience. And for me, I'm grateful. I tell people, you know, it's 50 years ago. I'm so glad I'm not dead. You know, it's like, I can tell somebody else, you know, because, you know, you really have to throw things two or three generations past you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're teaching the children for the next generation, but you have to try not to die.
Yeah.
Some of you have to not die.
That's right.
Three generations in front, somebody will be listening and hear and be inspired. I always think about the story my teacher told me, and it wasn't in the Georgia curriculum, about Harriet Tubman. And she said she was a conductor on the Underground Railroad, and she was taking slaves to freedom, and she never lost a passenger. She carried a gun. So if somebody got scared, she would... I mean, you know, I started school when I was four, right? I thought there was a tunnel under the ground because I didn't see nobody riding no train. And I thought it was a train. You know, there was a tunnel underground.
That's
and
right.
Harriet Tubman was driving the train.
That's right.
When I found out she was running overground, there was no tunnel. There was no train for her to drive. It was her feet. I said, okay, she needed a gun. She would have made it in SNCC, boy.
Well, but, you know.
And she said she never lost a passenger.
Never lost a passenger.
And I said, that's what they tell us. She, you know, she might have shot one of them people who got But, you know what I mean. It's just like the teacher was telling us something that wasn't in the curriculum. And I caught it. And I, there was just, and, you know, why they would tell us that story had to do with what they were having to survive.
That's right.
And they needed us to know that there was a Harriet Tubman who never lost a passenger.
That's right.
And she went against all odds. And, you know, I grabbed that image and just tucked it someplace. So when we tell these stories or share the stories that are in hand, it's nice to get together, those of us who are able to get together and share them, but we also are trying to throw them forward for people who will take the spirit of the stance and find out what that stance means in other generations.
And which is why I'm encouraging everyone within the sound of our voices this evening to join us Friday night at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African Culture and History. History and Culture at 830 East Pratt Street, 7 o'clock Friday night. Our guest this evening, Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, who was one of the original SNCC Freedom Singers, founded Sweet Honey in the Rock, curator emeritus of the Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of American History, is one of the great scholars and leaders in our country, along with the Reverend Cecil Gray, who's pastor right here in Baltimore of the Northwood Apple United Methodist Church and co-founder of the Freedom and Democracy Schools Foundation, who is the son of Victoria Gray Adams. Victoria Gray Adams and Bernice Johnson Reagan are two of the women who wrote for the book Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by SNCC Women, edited by six other incredible SNCC women. And they'll be on a panel presenting, talking to the public. You should bring your children. Young people come. everyone come to talk about the relevance of this in today's world, to hear the story of our history that is still alive. And I will see you all there Friday night at 7 o'clock, June 24th, at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. And all I can say is, Dr. Bernice Johnson-Reagan, it's just been a pleasure and an honor to have you on a radio show. And Reverend Cecil Gray, the same to you. Thank you both so much for joining us, and we'll see you Friday night.
Thank you for supporting this project. Thank you so much.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.